This is Graham Mount, Professor Emeritus of Laurentian University's Department of History in Sudbury, Ontario. And this is the sixth in a series of podcasts about travels in search of history. The fifth in this series dealt with an anachronism along the Mediterranean shoreline, Melilla in North Africa. The sixth in this series deals with another anachronism, Monaco. For further information and accompanying photographs, see my recently published book, Historic Pictures, Photos of Places in Transition, published in Toronto by Tellwell in 2025. As the Cold War was ending in 1989 to 90, and Europe appeared to be entering a period of almost universal democracy, Monaco remained one of the continent's last absolute monarchies. Given Monaco's geographical location, 2 square kilometers with a population of fewer than 30,000, surrounded by France on 3 sides and the Mediterranean Sea on the fourth, this was somewhat surprising. French revolutionaries of the late 18th century had emphasized their goals as liberté, égalité, and fraternité, with special emphasis on liberté. Elementary school children learned that France was, quote, the birthplace of liberty, unquote. Throughout France, dog owners had the liberty to let their dogs relieve themselves and leave the droppings where they fell. Across the border in Monaco, signs with a picture of a dog having a bowel movement warned, pollution interdite, pollution forbidden. Drivers in France had the liberty to ignore pedestrian crosswalks. In Monaco, they respected them. Panhandlers had the liberty to beg in prosperous French neighborhoods, but not in Monaco. France and Monaco had had a customs union since 1865, but behavior changed at the border crossing. Charles de Gaulle, president of France from 1958 until 1969, regarded absolute monarchy in Western Europe as an anachronism, but steps in the direction of more democratic government in Monaco proved minuscule. Gambling proceeds financed the government of Monaco, and residents of Monaco did not pay taxes. Without the power of the purse, taxation, residents of Monaco lacked the means to demand representation in their government. The adage, no taxation without representation, worked in both directions. Without taxation, representation was missing. One other difference between France and Monaco has been the status of the Roman Catholic Church. Since 1905, when the French government formally separated church and state, except during the Vichy period, 1941 to 45, France has been secular. French citizens can profess any religion or none, and no church receives public funding. By contrast, 4 cardinals who had to travel in the mid-19th century by sea from Italy to Monaco, numbered among the first visitors to the newly established casino, which they blessed. In so doing, they may have contributed an aura of respectability to a questionable enterprise. Proceeds from the casino provided housing for conservative clergy who fled to Monaco from Italy after the Italian army overran the Papal States in 1870, and from France after 1905. When France's Third Republic defunded the church, some priests feared that they might starve, but gambling proceeds allowed them to live in Monaco. On a visit to the Vatican archives in 1990, I noticed that the pile of 19th century correspondence with Monaco was about 1/3 of a meter or 1 foot in height. That with the United States, a mere centimeter. In 1990, I missed a day of research in Monaco because of Mi-Karem, halfway through Lent, a statutory holiday which fell on a weekday. In return for Monaco's cooperation and largesse, it appears that the Vatican grants some favors to the House of Grimaldi, Monaco's ruling dynasty. Pope John Paul II, on the papal throne from 1978 to 2005, reluctantly granted an annulment of the marriage of Princess Caroline, daughter of Prince Rainier III, Monaco's head of state from 1949 until 2005, reportedly because Rainier was threatening to withhold tithes worth millions of British pounds unless he did. Annulment allowed Caroline to marry her next husband in a Roman Catholic church and thereby legitimized the three children by her previous marriage, an important factor in a hereditary monarchy. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Laurentian University, where I worked, had a satellite campus at Villefranche-sur-Mer, a French community between Nice and Monaco. My first weekend there in January 1990, I visited the museum at Monaco's Palace of the Prince. The sign indicated a telephone number and a mailing address for anyone who wanted to do archival research. This seemed an opportunity. Gambling attracts tourists and finances Monaco's government, and governments in Ontario were contemplating an expansion in gambling opportunities. Why had Monaco become Europe's gambling center? What were the repercussions, positive and negative? Could Ontario and other provinces learn from Monaco's experiences? Within hours, I wrote to the archivist at the address indicated at the museum and explained what I wanted to research. Weeks passed and there was no reply. Concerned as my time in Europe was finite, I phoned and spoke to the archivist, one Monsieur Lecaillet. Monsieur Lecaillet advised that I must write a letter seeking permission. I told him that I had already done so, and he said, "Yes, I have your letter here in front of me. However, you wrote to me. You must write to the prince," unquote. Monsieur Lecaillet never identified Rainier III by name. He was always the prince. For me, seeking permission from the head of state was a novelty. Nobody who wanted to examine documents from the Public Records Office in London would have written to Queen Elizabeth II. Entry into the provincial archives of British Columbia did not and does not depend upon permission from the Lieutenant Governor. When I reacted with astonishment, Monsieur Lecaillet advised, quote, "These archives are not public. They are property of the Prince," unquote. Thus instructed, I wrote to the Prince. A few days later, Monsieur Lecaillet responded by telephone. "The Prince has approved," he said. "When can you come?" He and I arranged an appointment. In short order, I arrived outside the palace, where a uniformed guard saluted me. I told him why I was there, and he told me to wait. He entered the building and emerged with the news that Monsieur Lecaillet was expecting me. He escorted me into the reading room, where I met the archivist. At the time, I was 50 years old. Monsieur Lecaillet probably a decade younger, but he never indicated his first name. Monsieur Lecaillet introduced me to his two assistants, Monsieur Ruffino and Madame Innocenti. And although I returned to the archives two afternoons each week for the next 3 months, I never did learn their first names. "Monsieur Ruffino will photocopy any documents you desire," said Monsieur Lecaillet. As my visits to the Monaco archives predated the era of digital cameras, I expressed gratitude and went to work. The very first half hour, proved highly informative. From the Pyrenees to the Vistula, revolution swept across Europe in 1848, and Monaco was no exception. That year, because of a tax revolt, the Principality of Monaco lost 5/6 of its territory, including what are now the French communities of Menton and Roquebrune. Prince Florestan, head of state in Monaco from 1841 to 56, ordered an inquiry, and the investigators submitted a lengthy report. I asked Monsieur Ruffino for a photocopy. 20 minutes later, Monsieur Ruffino returned to say that permission had been denied. Monsieur Lecaillet later explained that nothing uncomplimentary to the House of Grimaldi, Monaco's ruling dynasty since 1207, could be photocopied. There and then, I decided not to make any further requests Rather than arouse suspicions about what I was doing, it was better to write everything longhand and say nothing. The documents which I examined came from the reigns of Florestan and his son and heir, Charles III, Prince of Monaco, from 1856 to 1889. All correspondence was incoming. What other people had written to Florestan or Charles III? Not a single letter originated with either of them. A few began with the words, quote, "In your reply to my previous letter, you said," whatever, unquote. Otherwise, historians such as myself could have no evidence of what the 19th century prince might have said or thought. In the end, I did produce an article mistitled "The Men Who Built the Bank of Monte Carlo," which appeared in the British publication History Today in October 1991. Monsieur Rofinot, a friendly fellow who always greeted me with a smile, proved useful on one other occasion. One afternoon, I had to relieve myself. He accompanied me to the urinals, as I could not be trusted to behave myself. That trip to the John did allow my one and only view of the Palace of the Prince, other than the museum and the reading room. It resembled the interior of the Titanic. French was the language of Monaco, the language of the documents, the language which we in the archives spoke to each other, and the common language throughout the principality. Once, however, I mentioned to Madame Innocenti that many outside signs were bilingual, in French and Monegasque. She replied, "Mais naturellement, nous sommes un pays." But of course, we are a country. One warm day, I was wearing a sport shirt and a pair of slacks when I reached the reading room. Monsieur Lecaillet was shocked. Quote, "They let you in dressed like that?" unquote, he gasped in horror. As far as he was concerned, the guard at the gate should have told me to return to Villefranche and dress appropriately. Quote, "The prince," he said, "wants researchers to wear a jacket and tie," unquote. I offered to leave, but Monsieur Lecaillet said that I could stay. However, I must never again dress in such an informal manner. Next time, I dressed in accordance with the instructions from the prince as interpreted by Monsieur Lecaillet, but there was a problem. To go from the Palace of the Prince to the railway station, I had to descend literally hundreds of steps. I feared that my leather shoes would slide and I would tumble. How often has the prince descended these stairs, I wondered. Thereafter, I wore jacket, tie, slacks, and running shoes with a grip. Nobody complained, and I felt safe. My time in the archives and my membership in Monaco's library led to the following thoughts. Isolated among the Alpes Maritimes and separated from the rest of Europe until the advent of tunnel technology late in the 19th century, Monaco traces its independence from the 12th century. Honoré II, who held the throne from 1604 to 1662, was the first member of the Grimaldi family to call himself a prince. In 1795, French revolutionaries invaded and annexed Monaco, deposing Prince Honoré III, 1733 to 1793. The Congress of Vienna, 1814 to 15, restored Monaco's independence, protected by the Kingdom of Sardinia. Florestan, the third ruler after the restoration of independence, had to deal with the tax revolt, and he realized that if he were to keep what remained of Monaco, he must finance his government in a way tolerable to his subjects. Gambling offered a plausible solution. As a gambling center, Monaco had advantages not readily available elsewhere. First, at the time, gambling was illegal everywhere else in Europe. The government of Monaco had a monopoly. Second, Monaco's climate is delightful throughout the year, a significant factor for the tourist industry. Third, large numbers of people live and lived within easy rail or road connection with Monaco. Four, as Monaco was not a democracy, its government could forbid the prince's subjects from gambling. The casino's purpose was the exploitation of foolish foreigners who would have to show their passports in order to enter the casino. Thus, even those Monegasques who lacked self-control could not lose their wages deprive their families, or otherwise create social problems. Yet, even with those advantages, gambling did not become profitable until tunnel technology allowed visitors easy access to the principality. A trip to Monaco by sea or by horse-drawn carriage over mountains was so time-consuming that gamblers had little time to try their luck. Despite problems created by a tax-free haven like Monaco, successive French governments have tolerated Monaco's independence and have had good reason for doing so. Canada's first king after the Congress of Vienna, Louis XVIII, King of France from 1814 to 24, brother of the guillotined Louis XVI, had to concentrate on the reestablishment of the French monarchy. Invasion of another country might have led to reaction from the Holy Alliance, which included most countries of continental Europe. Louis XVIII's brother, Charles X, King of France from 1824 to 1830, was more interested in Algeria than in Monaco. Charles X's successor, King Louis Philippe, 1830 to 48, pursued a cautious foreign policy. The Emperor Napoleon III, 1852 to 70, had his hands full with adventures in Crimea, Southeast Asia, Mexico, and Italy before he lost his throne as a result of war with Prussia. During the late 1860s, Napoleon III did send French police to the casino in an attempt to stop residents of Nice from gambling there, but the effort proved more trouble than it was worth. During the reign of Rainier III, Monaco became a tourist destination, renowned for its music, its Oceanic Museum, and the Monte Carlo Car Rally. Since 1929, the Monaco Grand Prix as well. Monaco had no airport, only a helipad for travelers from the airport in Nice. Because of the lower price structure, tourists often stayed in Nice or in French communities close to Monaco, rather than in Monaco itself. Monaco became a French asset, especially as President de Gaulle threatened to impose border controls unless the government of Monaco agreed that French citizens living or working in Monaco would pay French taxes. French citizens commuted to jobs there and then paid taxes in France. In the aftermath of the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine, Monaco's government, led by Rainier III's son, Albert II, who's been Prince of Monaco since 2005, Albert imposed sanctions upon Russian oligarchs, some of whom had stationed their yachts in Monaco. Monaco would cooperate with its Western European neighbors. Finally, without an army, Monaco poses no threat to the security of France or of any other country. As long as the House of Grimaldi produces heirs, Monaco appears likely to survive. However, sooner or later, the line may go extinct and France will absorb Monaco.